Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the Bay Area performing arts scene. I'm David LaTulipe, back again as your host, having taken a bit of travel and family time these past few weeks. Kudos and many, many thanks to Kevin Vance for taking the reins for the past several shows, and of course to volunteer producer Neil Swinkles for keeping the wheels greased and herding cats for Kevin. This week we'll hear about the forthcoming season of the San Francisco Early Music Society from its president, Robert Cole, the 2015 American Bach Festival, American Bach Society Festival, and Academy is in full swing. We'll hear from three of the participants, including the baritone Ben Cazes, who is featured in the prologue of Marin Marais' opera Semele, receiving its first performances outside of Europe tonight and tomorrow night. I'll also talk with Julia Rhodes, artistic director of Lucky Plush Productions, which is presenting The Cue at ODC. It unfolds in a fictional airport where travelers stumble humorously, tragically, and awkwardly into each other's private lives. Equally parts Slapstick and Busby Berkeley. You'll hear about that shortly. And Diane Keough offers an update and reviews of happenings a bit further down the peninsula, including a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum at Hill Barn Theater, and a film review. So do stay with us. Well, the American Bach Soloists Festival and Academy has been underway since last Friday, with a particular focus on Versailles and the Parisian Baroque through a series of concerts, free public lectures, and masterclasses. In addition, and naturally, Bach is a focal point for events happening through this Sunday, with a repeat performance for the concluding matinee concert of Johann Sebastian Bach's masterpiece, The Mass in B Minor. A major undertaking of the festival will be the first complete performances outside of Europe of the 1709 opera by Marin Marais, Semele, tonight and tomorrow night, under the direction of artistic director Jeffrey Thomas. Opera lovers may be more familiar with the George Frideric Handel setting of Semele, which tells the story of the title character, a priestess of Jupiter, and their illicit love affair. Marin Marais' version comes some 30 years before Handel's and includes an earthquake scene that has been described as among the most vivid musical episodes in early French opera. Marais followed in the footsteps of Jean-Baptiste Lully as master of tragic French opera and was hired as a musician in 1676 to the royal court of Versailles. He's credited with being one of the earliest composers of program music. His work, The Bladderstone Operation, for viola da gamba and harpsichord, includes composer's annotations such as, "The patient is bound with silken cords," and "He screameth." So we should be in for quite an earthquake scene in Semele. Unfortunately, that April 1709 production happened during what was called the Great Frost, an extraordinarily cold European winter, which led to famine and rioting. Not a great time to be thinking of grand opera in Versailles, and so the work, and opera in general at that time, languished. Yesterday, I had the good fortune to catch up with three of the American Bach Soloist Festival participants: Jacqueline Nappy, who hails from Durham, North Carolina, and played harpsichord in a Corey Jameson masterclass, as well as organ for the Bach Mass in B Minor; Holly Piccoli, an Australian native, who will be playing in the orchestra for Semele and takes the beautiful solo for the Laudamus Te portion of the B Minor Mass that we just heard; and Ben Cazes, a San Francisco baritone, who is the Grand Priest of Bacchus in Semele, a major role that starts the opera in an extensive prologue. My time with them began with a private concert by Jackie, reprising the Chromatic Fantasy from Bach's Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue, BWV 903, that she performed in masterclass, and here for an audience of one, me. Beautiful playing, Jackie.
Thanks very much.
Jackie, I understand the folks in Durham, North Carolina, at your church helped arrange the funds for you to come here.
Yeah, they did, which was really nice of them. It's a great place. It's a Lutheran church. And, you know, I told them I'd be playing lots of Bach, and I think they were really excited about that and thought it would be a good experience for me.
Is there much opportunity in Durham for you to perform Bach?
There is, actually. There is a nice little early music community there, and we're all really supportive of each other. I know at my church I try to have concerts there. There's other churches in the area as well that, you know, we all kind of try to stick together and perform together. It's a lovely community, so there are opportunities there.
The Mass in B minor of Johann Sebastian Bach will be performed next Sunday. It was performed last Sunday as well. Information about the performances of the B minor Mass at AmericanBach.org. Also joined by Holly Piccoli, who's a violinist from Australia, as I mentioned. She's in the orchestra for Semele and is also the featured soloist in the Mass in B minor. Welcome to you, Holly.
Thanks for having me.
A long trip from Australia.
That's true, although I've been in the country for a little longer than 6 years now, so I didn't have to make the 14-hour trip just for this. And, yeah, I've just been enjoying playing Baroque music in this country. I actually haven't played much Baroque music in Australia, so they'd be surprised to know I'm about to play the Lel Damos Te on Baroque violin.
Are you going back to Australia anytime soon to share your skills?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm going next month, mid-September, and I will be playing modern violin while I'm there. We're doing a performance of Les Illuminations by Britten, but I'm joined by the Sydney Dance Company. It's a big production.
And you've been studying this particular excerpt from the Mass in B minor with Elizabeth Blumenstock, who made the lovely recording with the American Bach Solos. What has Elizabeth brought to your interpretation of it?
Elizabeth has brought so much. She really opens your eyes to the phrasing that you're doing and the phrasing you intend to do, and perhaps it's not always the same. She gives such fantastic emotive and visual stimulation to perform what you want to do. And then at the same time, she gives you technical direction that just it just helps you do exactly what you want to do. And then finally, you end up doing the phrasing you always intended to do and committing to it. And then when you have something to say that's so strong and impassioned, then you're really making music. And so that's what she brings out. She just brings out all of the music.
In addition to performing in the Bach in B minor, you're also in the orchestra for Semele. What has that been like?
I've really been enjoying it. There is so much music to play. It's a very long opera. It includes arias and choruses and dance movements. And just to get through it all has been an accomplishment, really. And so then while playing so much of this music, Robert's direction, he is so visually stimulating as well that you can see how he wants the music to be played just by watching his body. But then, of course, you know, going into details, he tells you all about the different style ornaments and how they should be played. And then the different phrasing, it's a little different from Italian Baroque, this French Baroque music. And so just having so much music to play, you really eventually start understanding what the music looks like and then how it's going to sound. And so I've just learned a lot about French Baroque this past week and a half.
Well, we're going to hear more about the opera Semele by Marin Marais in just a moment, but I'm wondering if you could treat us to just a portion of the fantastic Laudamus Te from the Mass in B minor of Johann Sebastian Bach. Violinist Holly Piccoli, who's the featured soloist in the Mass in B minor with that excerpt from Laudamus Te, the Mass in B minor being performed at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music again this coming Sunday. Holly's also playing in the orchestra for the premiere performances of Marin Marais' Semele, an opera that hasn't seen the light of day for many a year, and here to help me shed some more light on the opera is Ben Cazes, a San Francisco baritone soloist who is the grand priest of Bacchus in the major prologue in Semele. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Ben, I mentioned that this is a major prologue to Semele. Perhaps share with us what this grand priest is talking about as he starts off.
Sure. So along with the grand priestess of Bacchus, we sort of introduced the entire production. We're talking, it was sort of a lot of very grand music that's honoring Bacchus, and of course, since he is the he transitions into music that gets increasingly more inebriated sounding, and then the grand priest himself is sounding a little bit drunk, and there's some very fun music that we were just rehearsing earlier today, that along with dances and an overture make up the entirety of a really great prologue.
Well, it's quite a convoluted story. Semele has been told by, most famously interpreted by Handel. This version was from 1709 and was an interesting year for opera in that not so much in favor in the Paris of 1709, and the entire of Europe was under a great freeze. And so not too much attention was being focused on the art, so it kind of languished for many years. When did you first discover Marin Marais' version of Semele?
This is definitely my first time encountering it. It's the first time that it's been performed outside Europe, is this performance of it. And I think for many of us, it was completely new. There are very few recordings of it, and it's just been such a joy to get to put together performance where you don't actually have all these different references and things to refer back to, that you can really feel like you can make it your own.
And you've been participating in the Academy this past week or so as well.
I have. It's actually my third time participating in the Academy along with the festival, and so the first 2 years were much more of a focus on German Baroque music, works of Bach and Handel and Buxtehude and so forth. And French is actually my first language, and I just love singing in French. And so when I saw that they were going to be having more of a French focus this year, I thought, okay, I definitely have to give this one more go.
What were the challenges of presenting and singing in French in a Baroque style?
Well, it's interesting. There are So the spelling that we're actually looking at in this French music is all a little bit different. And so for example, in modern French, you say faible to mean weak. And in the old French, it looks like it's written foible. So people can sort of debate about how to pronounce this old French. We've actually decided that for the clarity of communication, such for a modern audience, which may well include many French speakers in San Francisco, that we're using modern French pronunciation. So there's always a question about how you pronounce it. And then there are all sorts of questions about how you make this very literary French understandable to an audience. And so that's all the sort of a question of rhetoric and things that we've been talking about in a lot of our classes and lectures and so forth at the Academy.
Well, fortunately, the audience will be assisted by super titles for this.
Yes, thankfully. There's a very huge screen that they're using, and so it's, of course, all about the text. And so it's good that everyone will be able to understand what's going on.
Marin Marais's Semele will be performed here at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Information at AmericanBach.org. But first, I must say thanks to Ben, Holly, and Jackie for taking a little time this afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so
much.
Thanks
very much.
And now from the last night's dress rehearsal, a brief excerpt from the prologue of Semele. You'll hear Ben come through somewhat in the din of the fine orchestral playing under Maestro Jeffrey Thomas's baton. Marin Marais's Semele, a highlight of the American Bach Soloists Festival and Academy, receiving its first performances tonight and tomorrow night at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Information about those performances and the remaining events, discussions, and masterclasses at AmericanBach.org. A perfect segue from American Bach soloists, and looking ahead a bit to the very busy fall season of concerts, a preview next of the San Francisco Early Music Society, which begins its 40th season in late October. Joining me to talk about it is Robert Cole, the president of San Francisco Early Music Society, for a taste of what's to come. Robert received his MA in music from USC, where he studied with Ingolf Dahl. Later studies with Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood. He also served as associate conductor of the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. And from 1986 to 2009, he was director of Cal Performances at the University of California, Berkeley, bringing a remarkable array of top-drawer performers to the Bay Area. Among his many other credits, he conducted the Kirov Orchestra at the Mariinsky Theater in St. Petersburg, and also conducted at the Edinburgh Festival and Spoleto Festival, and since 1996, he has conducted the Hard Nut with Mark Morris Dance Group at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, Sadler's Wells in London, Bard College Festival, and Cal Performances. Distinct pleasure to welcome back Robert Cole to our airwaves.
Hey. Well, thank you so much. I didn't know you had that long resume.
I'm not catching that, Robert. I'm sorry. There you are. Hello.
Thank you very much. I didn't know you had that long resume there, but
well,
thank you.
It's distinguished, and not to mention that you're a Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres by the French government.
Yes, I didn't bring my medal, however, but thank you.
So an exciting season ahead for the Early Music Society, but let's talk about, you know, since we're just coming off of the American Bach Soloists and their workshops that are still going on, the San Francisco Early Music Society conducted a series of workshops this summer as well.
Yes, every summer, actually. And this summer and most summers we have, what we have is four different workshops. The first, this summer was for children, younger children in early music. And the other three were one, a recorder workshop, and a medieval and Renaissance workshop, and also a Baroque workshop. And I can say happily that all of these were oversubscribed this year, really, in other words, higher participation than we've had in the past. So it's very, very positive in that way.
Well, in addition to these workshops and the season that we're about to talk about, which begins in October, San Francisco Early Music Society is involved in many other activities.
Yes, it is a unique organization in this country of its kind, because we do these workshops, which we just mentioned, and we also have this concert series, which we're going to talk about a bit, which goes throughout the season. We also have an affiliate program where we serve as a fiscal sponsor for many, many organizations in the Bay Area. Initially, of course, we were the fiscal sponsor for Philharmonic Baroque Orchestra, for example, just to give us some idea of our role in the early music or music scene in the Bay Area. And also, every other year, we are the sponsors of the Berklee Festival, which is one of the major music festivals in America. So it's a very broad and it's a rather ambitious program that we are undertaking.
So let's talk now about the season that gets underway in late October with Archetti.
Yes, Archetti is a group of artists from the Bay Area, all of them. And they have this year a guest soloist, well-known here, Deborah Nagy, who's a wonderful oboe player, and I think is participating as well in the ABS program.
I was going to say, I think you'll have some crossover artists here.
Yeah, she's everywhere. She's here a lot. She's fabulous. And so she'll be here with Archetti, which is one of our premier local ensembles. When I say local ensembles, I mean from the Bay Area. But, of course, the Bay Area is really the center of early music in America. So, when I say local ensembles, these are nationally recognized ensembles. And then, of course, we bring ensembles from other places throughout the country for this series, one of them being the Baltimore Consort, which includes is a little bit different. It's not wholly Baroque music is the point. It's quite different. And then we'll have the annual Christmas program with Magnificat with Warren Stewart. And then one of the highlights of the season, of course, is, and they've been here before, is Quicksilver, this wonderful group from New York.
Well, let's back up just a moment and hear a little bit of music from Baltimore Consort. Their concerts in November are called The Food of Love, Songs, Dances, and Fancies for Shakespeare. And we have a little excerpt now called Join Hands. And then more with Robert Cole about the San Francisco Early Music Society. Thank you. Baltimore Consort in an excerpt from Join Hands by Thomas Morley. They're part of the San Francisco Early Music Society performance on November 2021 and 22. Robert Cole, the president of the San Francisco Early Music Society, here in studio to talk about the upcoming season as a prelude of good things happening here in the Bay Area.
Yes, I was going to talk just a moment about Quicksilver, which is a group coming from, some from New York and different places around the country. But the leader, one of the co-leaders of this group, is Robert Mealy, who's an esteemed violinist in the national scene, on the national scene, who lives in New York now, but actually grew up in Berkeley, went to Crowden Music School. He's really a local guy, and we're always delighted to have him back with this ensemble, which is really one of the best in the country, or in the world, actually. And he's joined with Julie Andrzejewski, who's the co-leader, and it's a wonderful group, which is, I think, one of the most popular groups that we've brought in the past. And then we have another group from Montreal, Ensemble Caprice, with Mathias Maute. And then I think you're going to play a bit of music later on with from Infusion Baroque, which is a group of young people, young women, four of them, who won the grand prize and the audience prize at the 214 Early Music America Baroque competition. And this is a... I've been on the board of Early Music America for a few years, and I just went off the board this last June. But this is something that Early Music America has done for some years, have a annual competition, national competition, actually including Canada. And these young people were the winners last year, and we are presenting them on their first national tour after that winning of that contest.
Fantastic.
Yeah. They also won a big contest in Utrecht, the Early Music Festival in Utrecht, where I'm going in 2 weeks, actually, by the way. So they were international winners, and we're bringing them here for their first tour.
Very nice. We're going to hear them shortly.
Good.
Let's talk about what you're doing in Europe.
Well, I'm going to the Utrecht Festival, which is in Holland, of course, and it's the oldest, largest, at least the largest early music festival in the world today. And I've been there before, and we have connections there. A lot of people I know will be performing there. And Vox Luminous, who was featured in our last Early Music Festival and will be featured in the next Early Music Festival as well, is the prime attraction at the Utrecht Festival this year, giving four different concerts. So we're sort of on the same track as Utrecht, and in that respect, that is the festival, the Early Music Festival.
Right, I imagine.
In June of 16.
I imagine you do some headhunting out there while you're...
Yes, indeed. And seeing some old friends and trying to find some new ones.
Right. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Robert, it looks like a wonderful season. I'm sure we're going to be having some guests on as the season progresses. The San Francisco Early Music Society subscriptions are available at sfems.org, no doubt.
40th anniversary.
40th anniversary season. We look forward to it. As we will look forward in March to Infusion Baroque. Here they are performing some music of Telemann. Infusion Baroque heard in March of 2016. Robert, I can't think of anyone else's hands San Francisco Early Music Society would be better off in. Congratulations on your great work, and thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Still to come, we'll have Diane Keough with a film review, as well as what's happening down on the peninsula, and a visiting group from Chicago next. But first, here's a little bit of Infusion Baroque and music of Telemann. Thank you. Telemann as part of the Infusion Baroque Tees. They're doing a program called Rebels and Rivalries as part of the San Francisco Early Music Society 40th anniversary season. Information about subscribing to their season and about the concerts to come at sfems.org. Music featured in The Queue, which opens tonight at ODC Theater on 17th Street here in San Francisco. It's the creation of Lucky Plush Productions, founded and artistically directed by Julia Rhodes, who joins me in studio to talk about the show. Julia has created over 25 works with the company, including 11 evening-length productions, several of which have toured extensively throughout the United States. She's a former company member of the San Francisco Ballet and a collaborating ensemble member of X-Site! Exclamation mark, Performance Group, among several other ensembles. With degrees in history and performance from Northwestern U and the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, she is currently a lecturer and dance advisor at University of Chicago's Department of Theater and Performance Studies. Welcome to Open Air, Julia.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I think we've all been there, an airport setting, wondering about the lives of the people we intersect with, if not interact with. Tell us the story of The Queue as you see it.
The Queue does take place in a fictional international airport, and it's really about that very question of how private lives can often slip into public spectacle when you are often doing very mundane things like just waiting in line. So that was one of the first impulses of the work. We see it every day. You might be in a cafe where you're overhearing somebody have a conversation, whether with another person or on the phone. And then suddenly you start to have maybe opinions about the conversation. You see other people hearing it. Maybe you become invested in their lives. Maybe somebody chimes in. And so we were just curious about how these things that happen every day would play out in the context of a show that takes place in a very relatable environment like an airport.
Like I said, I think we've been there ourselves, either vicariously living someone else's lives or just wondering what they're all about. Now, are the events in The Queue based on your own personal travel experiences or on perhaps some real characters?
Actually, they are a mixture of both. We had an early residency in New Zealand, which is when we kind of discovered that we wanted to have the context of The Queue take place in an airport, because there's just so much opportunity for relatable content. And the way we develop material with the ensemble is that it comes very much from their experiences. So a lot of the material, actually most of the material, is based on what we devise in the room, because we are kind of a devising ensemble. However, we did use some source material from different one-act plays. And the main one is oddly from 1746, called A Will or No Will. And it's sort of this farce about people that are vying for an inheritance. And so that kind of core story became the main sort of spine of our narrative. But everything else was built in real time in the room.
The pictures of the production on your website all have an atmosphere of comedy or absurdity or even parody. Now, it's all very lighthearted and humorous, and I'm wondering, is that your general mission in modern dance?
Well, I can't say so much in modern dance, but I can say that for us, humor is very important. And for me, it's really about creating a context through which audiences can really have an anchor in understanding the content. I think oftentimes in dance, humor is sort of indicated or it's on a certain kind of timing, which can be very fun and playful. I happen to be more interested in a kind of humor that's born out of the humanness and awkwardness and vulnerability based in real relationships between people. You know, sometimes it is very much a timed thing. Like, we used physical comedy in this piece, and we looked at old forms of slapstick and, you know, watched a lot of Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton films. And but, you know, humor is a thread in our work. And so we're very conscious of not using it sort of as a trope for the sake of itself, but really trying to find, like, what audiences are relating to and how it's so much about the relationships and the actual people on stage.
The production originated in Chicago. How many performances did you have there?
Oh, we actually had 3 weekends of performances there, so probably about 15. And then we had a post-premiere residency at the Flynn Center of Performing Arts in Vermont, which was really exciting because we're so interested in discovering what is working in real time with audiences. It takes that first run to really know what's working and what isn't. And so having an opportunity to sort of get back in a theater with tech and refine the show before touring was really great. And then we've been to locations this year, from Maui and Hawaii to Martha's Vineyard. We were there earlier this summer throughout the Midwest, and this is our first time here in San Francisco, so we're really excited.
Nice. So some minor tweaks to the production since Chicago and
Absolutely.
Then Vermont and the other places.
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of things have you found work better here in San Francisco, or are you about to find out tonight?
We're
and
about
then make
to find
changes?
Out. We're about to find out. One thing is that we have two versions of the show, just because of the way touring is. Sometimes you can't, you know, it's sometimes lower cost. The Claudettes, they are musicians that play in the show, and they are incredible. And we always want to have them with us, and they are here with us in San Francisco. But we have also toured a version of the show where it's pre-recorded. So sometimes we're tacking back and forth between different versions. But we do have our premiere version here with the Claudettes, and they are incredible. They're sort of like this neo-vaudevillian drum and piano duo. And because the nature of this show, we're working with some of these old forms of slapstick and vaudeville. It's just a real perfect fit.
We're going to hear more of their music as we conclude our segment together. But tell me now a little bit about your cast.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have 7 ensemble members in the queue, and they range in kind of background. Some of them came from classical ballet companies, some more contemporary jazz. But we all, you know, have a kind of a core vocabulary of movement that we work with. However, when we do develop work, they are generating a lot of the material because I want to foreground the individual performers in every show so the audience feels connected to them. And so we have one ensemble member, Megan Wilkinson, who's been with the company for 11 years, to a couple of them that have been with us for just about 2 to 3 years. And like I said, they just have a real diverse set of skills and backgrounds, which I love because I think it makes the performance more interesting.
So they're all involved in creating it as well. You're not just telling them what to do. They're giving input
all the time. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we create more kind of like an ensemble theater company that's devising original work. So in this piece, it was co-created with Leslie Buxbaum Danzig, and it's our second collaboration. She and I have a very similar sense of humor, similar sense of devising work. And we come into the room for the cue. You know, we had the idea, these sort of initial impulses. We were curious about blending these classic forms with more contemporary settings and sort of seeing how there's kind of an illogical yet logical rhythm to when something that happens in an everyday scenario kind of bumps up into this over-the-top sort of way of slapstick humor. It oddly makes sense. And so when we get into the studio, then we play with the ensemble members and we say, here are ideas. Let's watch this together. They learn things. I sometimes teach them a phrase. They might, a movement phrase, and then they might manipulate it with a different kind of prompt that I'll give them. And it's really all of that generative material is in service to the story that we're trying to tell or sort of the thematic material. But we're never sort of done making the show. It's constantly being tweaked and changed because for us, one of the central values is for it to feel very live and very kind of off the cuff.
Spontaneous.
Spontaneous, so that, you know, it feels like it's actually authentically happening in real time. And so a way that we do that is to keep making little tweaks and changes so that it never settles and goes into that very, you know, kind of show mode where they're just doing the thing that they know. Because we believe that audiences really do respond more to the work when they feel like the ensemble members, the performers, are actually having an experience on stage.
It's interesting you should say that, because with so often with these productions that tour of the classic musicals, you're not allowed to change a word or
right.
a phrase. It has to be exactly what Tams Whitmark says you can say.
Yeah, no, and we embrace the changes. I embrace the failure. We always kind of use the term fail forward in our room, or it's something that I say to them, like, yeah, make a mistake, because oftentimes the vulnerability or the thing that happens based on the mistake is much more interesting to an audience than, you know, just the thing that's done the right way every time. The tricky part is once something happens by mistake and then you incorporate it into the show, then it becomes a performed thing and you have to kind of keep provoking the situation that's going to help them to really feel the thing that made them vulnerable or have an experience the first time.
A lot of your productions are touring productions. Has that been the case with other touring productions that you've done? They've always been evolving as you go from city to city?
Absolutely, because I think these kind of core values about presence and liveness and sharing experiences with audiences in real time is a very central value of Lucky Plush. And we love that kind of value can be layered with very technical contemporary dance. Our dancers are incredible technicians. They are very skilled at what they do. And so we have so much fun in layering something that seems so difficult to people with this very off-the-cuff, easy conversational tone in the dialogue and their relationships.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a fun evening at ODC Theater. Opening tonight, that's Julia Rhodes, founder and artistic director of Lucky Plush Productions. ODC Theater presents the West Coast debut of their production of The Q. ODC is at 17th Street here in San Francisco. Performances Thursday through Saturday at 8 with live music from the Claudettes. And the Claudettes are drummer Michael Caskey and piano pounder Johnny Iguana. Julia, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, and let's hear some more music of the Claudettes that you can hear as part of The Q at ODC Theater. Here is Chin Up Tango. From the Claudettes, which will be played live and featured in The Q, which opens tonight at ODC Theater on 17th Street. Information at odcdance.org. The Q, equal parts dance and theater, tonight through Saturday at 8. Pleased to welcome back to the audio airwaves of KLW and Open Air, Diane Keogh, who's going to provide a little bit of cultural enlightenment about things happening down on the peninsula or on a big screen near you. Hi, Diane.
Hi, David. Well, first of all, last spring, I mentioned various places around the peninsula where youth could take classes in drama, dance and voice. And I went to three of the productions that were done by these students, all done by the Hillbarn Conservatory. Their ages 10 through 13, who did Cinderella, ages 14 to 17 did West Side Story, and ages 18 to 24 did Rent, which to me is one very difficult musical to do because it's a rock musical and everybody sings over everybody else, and besides, it's very sad.
I haven't caught it yet. I've had a chance to see it on Broadway, but I missed it.
Well, they've changed it because these are all things that are done, written especially for school editions, which means that they have taken out quite a bit of the language, which they certainly needed to do in Rent. And also, they've shortened all of them quite a bit because kids just can't handle that length. I don't know how they managed to get all these kids to do what they did anyway. I mean, you take a bunch of teenage boys and you teach them to dance in West Side Story. That takes a lot of doing. And the opening, particularly for West Side Story, is very heavy, very dramatic. And it was very funny because each one of these productions had only 3 weeks of rehearsal time, which to me is pretty also pretty amazing. And the classes were filled when they took them, but the thing is, of the 100% of students that applied, 30% were boys and 70% were girls, which doesn't bode well for theater in the future. However, a little story to tell about one of the boys. After a day's rehearsal for the opening number in West Side Story, which is a very involved, high-energy dance, one of the boys, who was a soccer player, asked the director why he was so tired. He couldn't figure it out. And she said, well, the dancing is a very physical activity. And the boys, all of them, suddenly had much more of an appreciation for theater because it's true and they don't understand it.
Well, speaking of West Side Story, I know you're going to talk about some film as well, but West Side Story is one of your coming attractions that's going to be happening with the Broadway by the Bay.
Yeah, Broadway by the Bay on August 14th is West Side Story. On August 27th, Hillbarn Theater is doing A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And I just saw the production at Foothill, which was splendid. It was so funny. Of course, it's one of my favorite plays anyway, because you come out of there feeling good and laughing a lot, and that's good for all of us. And on August 29th, TheaterWorks Silicon Valley is doing A Country House. Now, that will be a show about a group of actors who are going up to the country for a while, which should be very interesting, putting a group of actors together off stage and listening to them talk to and about each other. So I'm looking forward to all three of these things.
West Side Story at the Broadway by the Bay, broadwaybythebay.org, at the Fox Theater in Redwood City from the 14th to the 30th, and then in Monterey at the Golden State Theater from September 5th through September 13th, broadwaybythebay.org. And the Country House, a Broadway comedy by Donald Margulies, having its Northern California premiere at the Mountain View Center for the Arts. Information about those performances, which run later this month, August 26th through the 20th of September, at theaterworks.org. I should say theaterworks with an R-E.
TheaterWorks Silicon Valley.
Exactly. Oh, theater, yeah. .org. Now, we're going to get back to A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum shortly, but you've taken a little bit of a respite from the Peninsula heat by going to the big screens, too, haven't you?
Yeah, I did. I went to see something that everybody said, why are you bothering to go and see that? Because it had some pretty bad reviews, and that was Ricky and the Flash with Meryl Streep. Now, there are several women in the movies and in the acting that I think can do no wrong. Maggie Smith, Meryl Streep, Helen Mirren, no matter what they do, it's good. And so I went in with a bit of trepidation to see this because I do like Meryl Streep's work. I think she's excellent. And it's a dramedy with some really funny scenes. So Meryl Streep, if you can picture this, is Ricky, a guitar-playing, singing, and drinking-a-bit woman with overdone makeup, really bad hair, and way too much junk jewelry to go along with her bad outfits. She's living the life she loves and playing in a third-rate bar with The Flash, a rock group headed by Rick Springfield as Greg, who is, by the way, secretly in love with her, but she doesn't quite understand that. After one of the performances, she gets a call from her ex, Kevin Kline, who plays Pete Brummel. Her daughter, Julie, played by her real daughter, Maisie Gummer, and why she ever gave her that name, I don't know. I mean, it's Maisie Gummer. Anyway, and Maisie Gummer, her daughter, Julie, has tried to commit suicide, and she's been going through a really, really bad divorce. So Ricky leaves the motel in which he has been living and arrives at her ex's oversized McMansion with no money, so she stays in a guest room. Audra McDonald, the singer, that beautiful singer, is Maureen, the wife of her ex, who tries to make the arrangements pleasant while Ricky is there, but that doesn't work because Ricky is reminded over and over by her two sons and her daughter about the fact that she left her children when they were very young to take up her dream of being a rock star. So after a bit of problem, she leaves and she goes back, and the next thing we see, she's singing back in that awful bar. I won't tell you about the ending because I really don't want to give it away, but it's almost a foreseen ending. It comes out all right. I'm glad I saw the movie. There have been very mediocre and bad reviews. However, I was very impressed that Meryl Streep would make herself look old, worn out, and that I could see in her face the pain that she was going through with her children and the joy when she was playing and singing. And yes, she really did the singing, and she really did play the guitar. She, as I understand it, she took lessons for 1 month to play that guitar. And she was playing and singing. Now, her voice is not anything that you'd want to spend a whole lot of time listening to. Rick Springfield, on the other hand, pretty good, pretty good. A lot of women in the theater when I went, very few men, because it's kind of, as my son would say, a chick flick. But it's got more to it. There's more depth to it than you really think about. And if you can forget who Meryl Streep is while she's playing the part and believe that she is Ricky, then she's doing what she's supposed to do. And I did. I believed that she was Ricky, bad as it was. So I'm glad I went to see it. And I would say, yeah, go see it. It's worth it.
All right. Getting back to Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, that original soundtrack was one of the first albums that I got that just hooked me on Broadway. And it was one of the, I think it was the first full Broadway musical of Stephen Sondheim.
It was. It was his very first show, and I love everything he does, so I can't say it's my favorite. It's just one of my favorites of his work because the words are so clever. And the music is so good. Somebody told me recently, oh, all of his songs sound alike. I don't believe that. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum doesn't sound the least bit like Into the Woods, which doesn't sound like Reno Sweeney, which doesn't sound like Company. So I think they're confused because I love Stephen Sondheim's work.
Well, let's hear a little bit from that original track recording on an LP, which I pulled out of my own library, from tune that I particularly found clever was a tune called Impossible. And here's David Burns and Brian Davies as father and son, both being attracted by the same woman.
Why did he look at her that way?
Why did he look at her that way? Must be my imagination.
He's a lovely blooming flower, he's just a sprout. Impossible.
She's a lovely blooming flower, he's all worn out. Impossible.
Just a fledgling.
Just a man who needs a rest.
He's a man's boy and best.
Poor old fellow.
He's a child and mom's a test. He's too young to pass. Impossible.
He has asthma, gout, a wife, lumbago, and gas. Irascible. He looks tired. Father, you can lean on me, him, impossible.
Why did she wave at him that way? Could there be an explanation?
She may want mine, it's possible. He's a handsome lad of 20. I'm 39. It's possible. In a way, I'm 44. All right, 50. Then again, with love at my age, sometimes it's just impossible. I don't feel well. Son, a glass of water, please. Situation's fraught, fraughter than I thought, with horrible, impossible possibilities.
From the original cast recording, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. That was David Burns and Brian Davies with Impossible. Diane, thanks for coming in. I have just an excerpt, time for one last excerpt from Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum and the revival with Mandy Patinkin. So let's have a listen to that and the whole reason behind the slave Pseudolus seeking his freedom.
And I want to let you know that Dan Demers is playing Pseudolus. And Pseudolus, of course, carries that show. And Dan is perfect for the part. I cannot wait to see it.
Yes, Master? Get me that girl. And if I can, you are free. I am what? Free. Free. Oh, what a word. Oh, what a word. Say it again. Free. I've often thought, I've often dreamed how it would be. And yet I never thought I'd be. Once more, free! But when you come to think of such things, a man should have the rights that all others. Can you imagine what it will be like when I am? Can you see me? Can you see me as a Roman with my head unbowed? Sing it good and loud. Free, like a Roman, having rights and like a Roman proud. Can you see me? I can see you. Can you see me as a voter fighting graft and vice? Sing it soft and nice. Free, why I'll be so conscientious that I may vote twice. Can you see me? Can you see me? When I'm free to be whatever I want to be. Think what wonders I'll accomplish then. When the master that I serve is me and just me. Can you see me being equal with my countrymen? Can you see me being Pseudolus the citizen? Can you see me being give it to me once again? Free! That's it! Free! Yes! Free. Now, not so fast, I didn't think. The way I am, I have a roof, 3 meals a day. And I don't have to pay a thing. I'm just a slave and everything's free. If I were free, then nothing would be free. And if I'm beaten now and then, what does it matter? Free! Can you see me? Can you see me as a poet writing poetry? All my verse will be free. A museum will have me pickled for posterity. Can you see me? I can see you. Can you see me as a lover, one of great renown? Women falling down. Free? No, but I'll buy the house of Lycus for my house in town. Can you see me? Can't you see me? Be you anything from king to baker of cakes. You're a vegetable unless you're free. It's a little word, but oh, the difference it makes. It's the necessary essence of democracy. It's the thing that every slave should have the right to be. And I soon will have the right to buy a slave for me. Can you see him? Well, I'll free him. When a Pseudolus can move, the universe shakes. But I'll never move until I'm free. Such a little word, but oh, the difference it makes. I'll be Pseudolus, the founder of a family. I'll be Pseudolus, the pillar of society. I'll be Pseudolus, the man, if I can only be free.
Sing it!
Free!
Spell it!
F-R-double-E!
No, the long way!
F-R-E-E! Free!
Nathan Lane as Pseudolus. You'll hear Dan Demers in the Hill Barn Theater production on from August 27th to September 20th. Thanks to Diane Keough for coming in, as well as to Neil Swinkles for helping open air run. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening.